Today is June 9th, 2019. I'm Eric Ligi with the Rao Jewish History Program and Archives, and I'm speaking today with Beverly King Pollock at her home in Tucson, Arizona. And it's about 100 degrees outside, but it's cool and comfortable inside. So if you could start by telling me where you were born, where you grew up.
I was born in Bessemer, that's B-E-S-S-E-M-E-R, Alabama. Lived there till I was 6 and a half. And from what I can recall, my parents had it was probably a storefront store. I remember it was 50 cents down, 50 cents a week. So you can imagine what happened when the Depression came. There were no 50 cents anymore. So my mother and father decided to pick up roots and go to Atlanta, which is where my grandparents lived. But just a little bit about Bessemer. I can remember singing in the streets when my sister was born. My folks used to take me, and all the merchants knew each other. So it was lovely, and because I sang about my sister, I was so excited. And my mother told me the story about how when she was pregnant, I told my salesman, if my mother doesn't stop eating so much watermelon, she's going to pop wide open. So she never popped wide open. But anyhow, my sister was just about 6 months when we went to Atlanta. And before we left, my father stopped at the register as if money would appear. And he opened it up, and of course there was nothing there except a bunch of pennies. And he closed the drawer, and I said, Daddy, why didn't you take the pennies? He said, well, maybe the next guy needs it more. So we drove to Atlanta, and all I can remember about Atlanta, and my grandparents had three of their five sisters there. And I just remember love, just so much love and so much affection. And it was wonderful. I adored it. I had an Aunt Minnie who used to bite me, and I hated it. But when my sister came, she bit Sherry and said, and I was jealous.
What do you mean, bit you?
She just, I love you, and she'd bite me, you know. It wasn't a bad bite, you know.
A love nip.
It was a lovely nip, yeah. But that was kind of funny. And my grandparents had a little grocery store, and I don't remember too much about it, except that when I wanted an Orange Crush to drink, my grandfather would open it up and give it straight to me from the bottle. But when I asked my grandmother for an Orange Crush, she'd give it to me, but she'd take a swig out of it first and then give it to me. So why I remember such important things, I have no idea. But my grandmother could, well, her English was not as good as my grandfather's. My grandfather came to the country a couple years earlier. And then when he had the money, he brought us over. And I think one of my daughters, I believe, had the boats that they came over on, which was very interesting. I know they had the one that my husband's father came over on. How they could find it, God knows. I guess it's the newfangled things from ancestry. Yeah. So let me see. That's probably about Bessemer.
Where in Atlanta did you live?
In West End. My grandparents, I don't know where we lived there for a while. But my Uncle Saul, who was Aunt Minnie's husband, the sisters were my mother, Aunt Minnie, Aunt Molly, Aunt Jeanette. She and her husband, the ones that introduced Mel and me, and Aunt Babe.
And your mother's name was what?
Ella. Ella. E-L-L-A. And we stayed with my grandparents until Uncle Saul, who was a saint, he found a grocery store not too far from his where he could keep an eye on Daddy and help him because Daddy never knew groceries. And interestingly enough, and years later, my grandfather got a job with Aristocrat Dairy. And the reason for that is that most of the Jews who came over, most of them were grocery people. And so, as a consequence, my grandfather knew everybody. And he would. Somebody would say, "Well, I'd like to borrow $5,000." My grandfather would say, "Sure." He'd sign for it. He didn't have 5 cents, but he knew that the people would always pay it back, and they did. That was the Hebrew Free Loan Society.
He was on the Hebrew Free Loan of Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's how that came about. And let's see.
What was the religious life like? Did you go to synagogue?
Yes, we did. We had a conservative synagogue. It was Ahavath Acham. And I'm not quite sure where it was. I seem to remember 10th Avenue, but I don't trust me because I can't recall. But it was the Orthodox shul. And I may have told you about the time that my girlfriends and I, we were going on 13. Do you want to hear that story?
Sure.
But by the time my girlfriends and I, we were going, I lived in West End, and my folks drove, you know, of course a block from the synagogue, because parish forbid people should know that you drove. And so they dropped us off, and I went in and dutifully to the synagogue and dutifully kissed my grandmother, and she could yell, let's say, "That's my nanicle." And then I would go out with my girlfriends. And we'd stay at services for a little bit, then we'd sort of ease to the door. And so we went to sit in Sarah Spielman's grandmother's house, which, interesting enough, had a little bakery attached to it. So anyhow, we're sitting there, and her parents were very Orthodox, so there was no way we'd turn on the lights or anything. But it was quite cool. And we decided we were going almost 13, and we were going to fast. And all of a sudden, we start hearing the music of the different stomachs going up, you know. And so finally, Sarah said, "Well, you know, my grandmother had this store, and she's got some stale cookies or stale cakes, and I can take those, and we can go outside and eat it." So we went outside, and we went to the drugstore because it was nearby, but we knew nobody would be there because it was, you know, everybody was in services. So luckily, Beatsy had a dollar, and she paid for chocolate milks for us to eat with the pastries. And of course, who would spill the chocolate milk down the white piping of her new green dress was me. And I at that time there was no such thing as a public restroom, so I asked the guy if I could go in and try to clean it up. And of course I didn't know how to do it, and it was pretty messy. So my girlfriends were very heroic when I got out. They stood in front of me so that nobody would see what I looked like until I went home. And I got in the car, and my daddy didn't say anything. And my mother said, "See, I told you God will punish you if you do the wrong thing." So mother was always a "God will punish you if you do the wrong thing."
Was she more religious than your dad?
Yeah. But it was just something in the background, really, than service. Although, when I take it back, I graduated from school, and I wouldn't call it the valedictorian because it wasn't that. It was just sort of like an after dinner speech or something. I remember giving it, teasing where everybody was going to happen, you know, when they get older. But I could remember that, and I sort of remember. I'm jumping to Atlanta toward the end. You'll have to separate it. I belong to this club called Cardosians. It was named after Chief Justice Cardosia. So we had like a little event, and I was the mistress of ceremonies, and I was known for my puns. I used to make a lot of puns. And so there was another guy sitting across the table, and he started answering my puns with puns of his own. We would pun back and forth. It was kind of fun for me. And finally he said, "Let's Beverly the Hatchet." And I knew I could never do a pun better than that. So anyhow, he became my boyfriend. He was a senior at Georgia Tech, and I was a senior at Girls High. And
his name was?
Leon Rockamora. And my mother always worried that he wasn't Jewish. Because, whoever heard of a name, Rockamora. But he was either Spanish or Portuguese, I've forgotten which. When I graduated from high school, my parents sent me to visit my aunt in Williamsport. This is the Aunt Jeanette, you know.
Yeah. How did she end up in Williamsport?
Her husband. Oh, what has... another story. Melvin's father and a cousin, Jack, and somebody else. I think Melvin's father. No, I said Melvin's father. It was another somebody. I can't recall who. And they all were coming from somewhere up north down to south to visit the relatives. And while we were there, Uncle Herman, Uncle Herman was one of the three. Herman, Samuel, and Cousin Jack. And while they were there, they made a shidduch with Aunt Jean and Uncle Herman. So they got married while they were there. And from there they went, it was just Uncle Herman and Aunt Jeanette that went to Florida for a vacation, not the rest of the guys.
Why did the brothers come down south?
Because they had relatives. Some of my relatives are mixed up.
Okay.
I mean...
So the families were related before you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's why when Melvin's mother and father and brother, they were on their way to Canada, and she got sick. And they stopped at Uncle Herman's place, and Uncle Herman and Jean. And she called up Melvin, who was living in Gallitzin, and said, "Come here." He said, "But who's going to take the store, take care of this?" So she says, "Come here." So he came, and we met. And I think I told you the first date, neither one of us saw each other's face. They insisted we go swimming. And
that wasn't the first time he saw you, though.
No, he saw me in Williamsport.
Because he came to pick you up.
Yeah, he was able to use their Packard car, which was a big deal at the time. And so on our way down to the swimming hole, I could only see the left side of his face, and he could only see the right side of mine, or maybe that. Yeah.
The flip.
Maybe it's wrong, but whatever. And so he said, I'll meet you right here afterwards, you know, to go swimming." In those days, you had to go to a bathing house to change your clothes. So I went there, and as I'm there, I'm thinking, "My God, I don't know what he looks like." Unbeknownst to me, he's thinking, "My God, I don't know what she looks like." So I got dressed, and I went to the appointed spot. And this good-looking guy says, "You ready?" I said, "Yeah." So it's a good thing he remembered, otherwise I'd still be there. And he told me later that the reason he knew I was in the right spot is that I was taking my bathing suit out of my towel, and he saw the red and white flowers. So he figured it was a pretty good chance that I was the right person.
Unless two people had the same bathing suit.
Unless we would have been in trouble. I might not be here then. So, anyhow, they kept pushing us together, and I didn't really especially care for him. Rocky, by the way, came to see me from... He was sent to Cornell as an ensign in the Navy. And so I was really not particularly crazy about Mel for the first couple of dates. And then I think it was the third date. We were driving, and I never saw a moon like that in my life. It was huge and orange. I said, "Oh, what a beautiful moon. Did you ever see a moon like that?" He said, "I had the boys put it up just for you." And I fell madly in love with him at that time. When I told my girls about it, they said, "Mommy, you fell for that story. That you fell for that line." I said, "You're lucky I did, otherwise you wouldn't be standing here today." So, Anyhow.
So how soon after that did you guys get engaged and then get married?
Well, I think we got engaged when, I think it was the next year, because I can remember Melvin's mother. I was visiting in Williamsport, and maybe I was visiting Mel, and he said, let's get engaged. And so she sent us to Pittsburgh on the train.
Who's she?
Melvin's mother. Sorry about that. She sent us to Pittsburgh on the train, and we got off and went to this wholesale jewelry place that she recommended. And we looked at my ring, and it didn't fit it, so we had to come back afterwards. And before we went back to Glitzen, and so we went to pick it up, and Melvin, instead of giving it to me there, he picked it up. He says, "I want to think about this first." And then we went back on the train, and of course he gave me the ring immediately. But that was just his little joke, you know. I could imagine what the salesman was saying. Oh my God, you know.
What do you remember the name of the store?
No, it was some jewelry store. I have no idea. And all I know is it was in Pittsburgh. And we went back. You know, it could have been Gallitzin. It could have been Williamsport. Frankly, I don't recall. But
where were you married?
We were married in New Haven, Connecticut. Melvin was sent. He was in the Army. You know, it was during the war. And in 1944, we got married. But before then, he was sent to. I remember visiting him in St. Louis. And he was visiting another place. And then he was in Yale. So my husband was a Yale man. Yale sent him to a school. First he studied meteorology. And then they found out they had too many meteorologists. And then they studied some kind of radio or some kind of technology, which really was not Mel's forte. And so he was staying at Yale, being ready to be transferred, and he picked up the phone and he said, "Hey, would you like to come down this week and get married?" And I knew Mel felt funny about getting married. He said, "If I could just walk through a door." I don't know why he was very upset about it, but anyhow, he came.
What do you mean, walk through a door?
And just walk through a door and be married, you know.
It was the whole ceremony of it that was.
Yeah, something. I think it was. I don't know what it was. But anyhow, so I told Mother, "We're getting married this week." She says, "Oh, good." She says, "I'll come. I'll come, and Mom will come, and Auntie Henny will come, and the sisters will come." And I'm thinking to myself, "Oh, God, he's going to change his mind." So anyhow, I came, and he had found an apartment for us. And in New Haven, Connecticut. Russell and Ruby Burgess. And don't ask me why I remember, but I do. And so he found the apartment for me. And the mother with the sisters and so forth, there were five of them, stayed in one hotel at the McAlpin, stayed in one room at the McAlpin Hotel. You know, life was different in those days. You couldn't just find a hotel room right away, you know. So they were lucky. So in the meantime, unbeknownst to me, Mother had a couple of experiences. She went to call Daddy to tell him that they arrived safely. And then she came back to the hotel. And all of a sudden she realized her pocketbook was gone. She had $300 in it, all the money she had in the world. And she didn't want to tell Mama, my grandma, who would be hysterical. So she and the aunts were looking like crazy. And finally, Mother went back to the telephone booth at the end of the hall. Nobody had come in since she left. And there was her pocketbook with the $300 in it. Can you imagine? Today, a phone, first of all, every room has a phone. but the phone was at the end of the hall, and nobody had used it within that hour. So she recovered her money. Another happening was they were unpacking their clothes, and she hung up my wedding dress. No, and she hung up her dress, you know. And unbeknownst to her, my wedding dress was attached, and it fell in the toilet. Well, you can imagine those five women. They were insane. So they called downstairs. And in those days, the door had like a little something in it where you could hang your clothes or put your shoes in it if you wanted them to be shined. So I quickly put the dress in there, and they picked it up. And we listened. They couldn't go to sleep that night. And they're finally at 4 o'clock in the morning. They hear this click inside the door. You know, they had this dress hanging inside the door. So they quickly pulled it out. Oh, it looks too long here. Oh, it's too short here. Or this or that. They were absolutely hysterical. So when it came to bring it to my house, they took my apartment. They didn't say a word, and I didn't know the story about the wedding dress until 7 years later. Mother decided it was time to tell me. She figured the marriage was safe enough. But there were other stories that I can recall, whether you want them or not.
Yeah, if you've got them on the tip of your tongue.
We just gotten married. And all of a sudden, I got this terrible boil on my left cheek. Well, you have to remember, we were terribly naive. I was very naive and very, very, very inexperienced in the ways of love. And here I am with this awful boil, and it's killing me. And finally, I had to tell Melvin. So he took me to the doctor, and the doctor said, you lie down and have your husband put this compress or something on it. And after so many days, chances are it'll pop open. You'll be all right. So Melvin went to Yale in the morning. He put the compress on. He came home for lunch. He put the compress on. He came home for night. He put the compress on. And the second night, here I am like this, and he's put in terrible pain, and he's putting the compress on. He says, you know what I like most about being married, about married life? I like coming home to my wife's smiling face. Oh, geez, I laughed like heck. It eventually popped open, but that was so terrible at the time, so embarrassing. But those were some of the funny things, but they were happy days, even though we were, in retrospect particularly, because we didn't know where Mel was going to be sent. And he was sent to India for 13 months.
Where did you live while he was over there?
I was living in Atlanta for the most of the time. But then Uncle Herman wrote a letter to Mel's dad, and said Mel's dad was by himself. It was October. And he said, Christmas is coming on. He's going to need somebody to help him in the store. So you should go there and help. So I left Atlanta, and I went to live in Gallitzin with my father-in-law.
What was Gallitzin like in the 40s?
Small, about 2,500 people. If you count the bars particularly, there were lots of them. Because I remember one time when Mel came home, he said he was introducing me to, and all the bars, they wanted to insist that you have a drink. And Melvin said, use the cheapest one because I don't want you, you know. I got so sick. I never had a drink in my life except at Passover. So anyhow, I came home. I remember that night, and oh God, I was that sick. And the main thing to do was to keep from Melvin's dad knowing it. So he didn't. At least he pretended he didn't. But he was a tough guy. He was a short guy. I guess he had the small guy's complex. But
this is Sam?
Yeah, Sam. And I remember when he was dying, and Mel, this was after the war, 1948, and Mel and I were there, and he said, "I never said it before, but I want you to know that I love you." That was really a very touching moment, because he was a guy who just never talked about affection, you know. In those days, parents didn't. You know, they worked real hard. You know, most of them came from Eastern Europe, and they worked day and night, you know, to make it. And when I think back, I would think about how strong they were, and we never realized it at the time. We were too immature, I guess.
Were there any men in Gallitzin at the time, or were they all off in the service?
They were all, well, except for Joe. We had a salesman who was named Joe, who was very tiny and very thin. And Joe could do anything. He could sew, he could put hems on pants and sew and do all kinds of things. And Joe had just one trouble. He would pilfer merchandise. And so Melvin was very upset by it. His father said, "Look, he's not being paid enough, so don't worry." You know, that was his logic. Joe was very important. We had to have him. But he was a little guy. And I remember when Melvin had died, Melvin's father had gotten married to Rose Goldberg.
This was a second marriage?
Yeah, yeah. It was, his mother died in 1947. I think I said how old she was at the time.
Yeah.
And Rose was sweetest lady in the world. She took care of our kids. They called her Aunt Rose. And she was a wonderful, wonderful woman. And after Mel's dad died, she continued to live with us. And she took care of the books. And so that she always had a, you know, somebody to look after and take care of her. And later years, when we were, must have been toward 1960, we were thinking about the closing of the Gallitzin store, because although we did sell it, and she had an apartment in Wilkinsburg, which is near Gallitzin, and she had the store. She took care of the books there, so she had her own privacy there. And later on, she did move to, we were getting ready to move, she moved to Altoona, and she stayed with Melvin's brother and his wife for a little bit. And they went on vacation, and her brothers talked her into going to Geisinger Clinic, and she never came out of there.
What was Geisinger's?
It was a clinic, some kind of clinic, you know, to help you get better, to help you get well. I don't remember.
Yeah.
I just remember she went there. And she wanted to come home. And we just felt so terrible, but there was no way we could take care of her. And she died shortly afterwards. And Larry, we took Larry with us. Larry was about 15. And after we left her, he cried so hard. You know, it was sad. She was a good lady, Rose Goldberg. She used to work in a mattress factory. She was head of a mattress factory. And so as a consequence, her voice was a little loud because she was giving instructions over the sound of the motors, you know.
Yeah.
So she spoke a little bit loud, but heart of gold, heart of gold. And
what else do you remember about the store?
Now, so it was what Menashe Skolnick would call a department store. Not a department store, a department store. And they had, the aisles were sway back, and the socks and work handkerchiefs were hanging on strings from the ceiling. So if you wanted a pair of socks, you just pulled it down. You wanted a work handkerchief, you just pulled it down. Well, Melvin thought that was so terrible because it was so old-fashioned. So he said, Dad, look, I never asked you anything before, but I would like to change, to take down the socks. He said, it's so old-fashioned. And here's a beautiful little display case. We can display it. And Melvin's father said, okay. Well, to make a long story short, sock sales dropped 60%. The next thing he did, we put them back up on strings on the ceiling. Because whenever you walked in the store, you bumped into the socks, you know. So that was why they were such good sellers. That was funny. But I can remember when we were getting ready to leave, and there was some guy, I can't remember his name, he took care of selling old stuff that was left over, you know. We did sell the sort of Schulman's, but they, this is before then, we tried to sell as much inventory as we could because they didn't want any more than they had to pay for.
Was this a liquidator?
Yeah.
Was it one of the 40 thieves?
I don't know whether he was a 40 thief or not. All I can remember is he went into, we had a case that had a glass, it was in a glass case where we had all the men's suits, you know, and glistened men's suits. Who would wear to a funeral, maybe? So anyhow, so we go in there, and we listen to him. He's saying, Yikadal, Yikadal, Shemay Rabba. So funny. Because I guess we were always looking for the funny things. But anyhow, that was funny. Because those suits, you know, we had marked $40. We were lucky if we could get 10 or 5. But anyhow, so we did sell the store, and Rose moved to Altoona before then, I think.
What year did you sell the store?
You know, I know that we moved to, Melvin moved the children's clothing store to the Miracle Mile in 1954.
So sometime before 54?
So, yeah. We had the store, he had a store in a place called Geistown, a children's clothing store. So he moved most of the fixtures and things there. The Geistown was a nice store, but, you know, it was not holding its own.
So you were in Gallitzin for about a decade?
Probably. I remember 13 years. Don't ask me why. But I recall thinking it was 13 years.
So you had kids in Gallitzin?
Oh, yeah, all four of them.
What was it like raising a Jewish family in Gallitzin?
That's why we left. Because there were no... Actually, the Isaacsons were the only other Jewish family there.
What did they do?
They had also a department store, you know, smaller than ours. But old man Isaacson would turn out the lights, except one light. He wouldn't keep them all on if nobody was in the store. And we used to joke about that. There was another guy named Mr. Spector who repaired watches. And he had a little jewelry store, too. I remember that. So these three families were the Jews there. Although, the story that some of... I'm not sure about that. Pollux was a big store there. It was a full block. But it was an old-fashioned store, you know, not a big money store.
So if you needed...
But it helped us.
If you needed a Jewish community, where did you go?
We went to Altoona. And that's where we went to services, and that's where our Jewish friends were.
How often would you go there?
We used to go almost every Friday.
So you'd drive to Altoona every Friday?
Yeah, yeah. And gee, one time it was snowing terribly. And going up that mountain, you know, was straight up, it was scary. And I was really afraid of driving, but Melvin did it, and boy, it was tough getting up the hill.
Isn't Gallitzin near the horseshoe?
Absolutely. Oh, that's another interesting story. Because the horseshoe curve needed an extra engine to push it up to the top. And Gallitzin was at the top of the horseshoe curve. They always dropped off the extra engine in Gallitzin, which meant that political people who would be on the train, they would come and stop. They see the train is at a stop. They're people. You get out and you talk. So we saw Truman. We saw Eisenhower. We saw Adlai Stevenson, whom I loved. And I've forgotten who else we saw. But anyway, we saw all that line of...
These were during FDR, the campaigns.
During the campaigns. So what happened is we said, oh, the engine's coming to stop. The word would come across, would be passed at the town. So everybody rushed to the station to hear them because we knew they would come out and talk. And so we saw all the big political figures of the day. That was kind of interesting in retrospect when you think about it.
Yeah.
And I, to this day, am a political junkie.
Because of that?
No. I just am. And sometimes it's a little difficult when you can't see when it comes to changing channels. So I just mostly listen to MSNBC.
Yeah.
So.
When you went into Altoona, did you also take the kids to Hebrew school there?
Oh, yeah.
Sunday school there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And which synagogue in Altoona did you go to?
It was a Havithachim.
Which is the conservative one?
Yeah. Oh, no, wait a minute. That's, no, that's not the name. It was Temple Beth Israel. Temple Beth Israel.
So it was Reform.
Yeah, yeah.
What was it about Reform that was appealing? It wasn't what you grew up with.
All our friends were there. And Melvin's brother and his wife were ahead of us, and they joined it. And, of course, they told us to join it. They asked us to, and we did. And all our friends were there. I can remember, it's funny, I can remember a New Year's Eve at Dutch Kitchen, and everybody was telling jokes, you know, slightly off-color jokes. But that was New Year's Eve. Later on in Pittsburgh, well, I'm jumping a little bit, but it's a New Year's Eve. There were eight families where we moved into. 1950, Melvin moved the store in 54. We moved there in 1957, January the 4th, I think. See, I remember the important days. And we loved that street. It was so wonderful.
This is in Monroeville?
It's in Churchill.
Churchill.
Yeah, which is a suburb of Monroeville. And should I go back to Gallitzin?
Yeah, let's go back to Gallitzin for now, and then we'll pick up with
okay,
Monroeville.
That's what I figured, yeah.
What was the Jewish life in the home? Did you light candles? Did you keep kosher?
Did not keep kosher. Rarely lit candles. No, that's not true, because we may not have started with it, but we ended up with it because we wanted our kids to be Jewish. And that's really the reason we left Gallitzin, because there was nothing there Jewish. And, of course, we found it in Churchill. And that wonderful street with eight families, of whom seven were Jewish.
How much longer would the store have lasted if you had stayed?
Well, we sold it in 1960, and Shulman's kept it for quite a while. We don't know what happened. We know all of a sudden the building fell down. It was an old building. It had three flights.
Did they build the building or buy it?
They bought it. I think it was $10,000, which was nothing.
Did they live there, too?
I don't think so. They probably lived in Johnstown. We lived in Altoona. No, that's not true. We never did.
You lived in Gallitzin or you lived in Altoona?
We lived in Gallitzin. Never really lived in Altoona.
Yeah.
Our social life was there.
Right.
But,
So when you decided to leave Gallitzin, there's any number of places around Pittsburgh that had Jewish communities. You could have come to Squirrel Hill. You could have gone to the South Hills. So what was it about Monroeville?
It's very interesting well, of course, we had the store there. The store was in Monroeville.
But
it was really because what happened is in 1960, I remember the date, my father had a stroke. And so Melvin drove me to the airport in Pittsburgh. And on the way back, he saw a sign, shopping center coming up. And so he stopped there and talked to the sales guy. Malva said, look, there's nothing here. There's not a building. There's not a house. There's nothing here. How you gonna? And the guy says, believe me, you build it and it'll come. And we were the first, it was the first Miracle Mile in western Pennsylvania, maybe even Pennsylvania, I'm not sure. But the Miracle Mile Shopping Center. So Melvin talked to the guy, and he may have even signed something then at the time. But I know that the mile opened in 1954, and Mel lived there in a, it was some kind of motel that he just slept there, and then he came home on weekends, and I hated it.
So you were still living in Gallitzin, but he had still moved the store to the Miracle Mile.
Yeah. In the meantime, I got pregnant with Bobby. So that was our fourth kid. Bobby was born in 1955. We moved to Churchill in 1957. And we had this Diffenbachia all that was there, and we kept having cuttings of it all over the world.
So what was... There really wasn't much of a Jewish community in Monroeville at that time, was there?
Well, we were not the actual charter members, but we came very early on. And we were sort of like a little family. You know, we met in various homes. And this one rabbi, his name was Richard somebody, I cannot remember his name to save my life. He was the first rabbi. But we had services only every other Friday, because he couldn't come all the time. So we had every other Friday. Well, lo and behold, Rabbi Edelstein comes in. He tells us that Shabbos is every Friday. We were shocked. You know, I'm being facetious. but you know, people get upset by stupid things.
Right.
So, anyhow, so we started having services every Friday night. And then he decided that the children over a certain age, they should go to Hebrew school. They should have religious school twice a week. I thought that was terrible. I signed a petition. I was wild in my early days. And happily, Rabbi Edelstein won. He would not back down. And Temple David's a wonderful place now.
So just to go back, you guys leave Gallitzin because there's not enough of a Jewish community.
Exactly.
The store is where it is. There's nothing you can do about that.
Right.
But you could have lived in Squirrel Hill and he could have commuted to Monroeville. Why live in Churchill where there also was not a huge Jewish community yet?
Well, I don't know. We just wanted to move to a place where there were a lot of Jews. And though I just said the 7 out of 8 families on our street were Jewish, and the 8th family was Jewish too, even though they weren't. He was a genius. His name was Bill Mullins. And he had some big something in CMU. He was some kind of engineer. He headed the whole department or something. He was a bright, bright guy. And he married this blonde woman. I said, just like a guy to marry the dumb blonde. She happened to have graduated from the University of Chicago. She wrote several books. And she was a good friend of ours, too.
So early on, you guys were meeting in each other's homes?
Yeah.
So you were there before it was chartered?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I can remember meeting one time in this home. And there was a hole in the floor, and you could step down in it if you weren't careful.
Because the house was still being built?
No, because it was an old house. And it was all we could rent, apparently. And then this church nearby, and I can't remember the name which church it was, they lent us we were able to get their premises. And so we had our services there. And they didn't mind that we put a blanket over the cross at Christmas time. And they were really very, very accommodating, very nice. And Melvin belonged to Rotary in Monroeville. And a lot of our friends were there.
Was there any interaction between Monroeville and the city congregations or the city community?
What happened is what is happening now, anyhow, is that there are three congregations, Monroeville,
Parkway Jewish Center?
Parkway Jewish Center. And there's another one, maybe one or two, Oaks, something Oaks,
Green Oaks Country Club?
No, not that. It was another congregation. And I know that now we have big services together because there aren't that many people and it costs too much to have programming, you know.
I never knew there was a third Monroeville congregation. I knew about Temple David this and Parkway.
This is not a third congregation. This is now. It's another congregation that's on the periphery. And I cannot think of the name of it.
But Jewish.
Oh, yeah.
It's in the eastern suburbs.
Yeah, yeah. And they had their services together. And Rabbi Simons, of course, Temple David, she is so wonderful and so bright and so full of ideas. She's terrific. I just hope she never leaves it. Her son just graduated from high school. So now is a nervous-filled time, you know. One of her girls already got accepted into rabbinic school. And I forget what the other one's doing. But the whole family is wonderful. I remember my girlfriend Shirley Katz and I think I told you, she and I wrote a lot of skits for the temple each year. And in the early days, we had lots of aggravations. And we would make fun of them. And they'd kind of disappear, so it was good. I think I may have told you that Rabbi Edelstein, one time, as a matter of fact, the first time after our show, he stood up and everybody applauded. It was really wonderful because he doesn't stand up just for anything, you know. He obviously liked the story we told. But Temple David was great, very important to us. And Shirley Katz came in later, and she and I became writing partners, and she and her family joined the temple, too.
Who were some of the other early families, or some of the families on your block, those seven families?
Oh, the seven families, Larry and Claire Levine, Mike and Marcella Allen, A-L-L-O-N, us, Edie and Leon Nagin, then the Mullins that I told you about, Bill and June Mullins. Then Harriet Lebby. You know, I can't remember what her husband's name was. And then Bob and Barbara Bronk. So, as I mentioned before, on New Year's Eve, you know, you can't get a sitter. So we would go into each other's houses. And we'll have maybe hors d'oeuvres in this house, maybe something other. It was just such a wonderful, wonderful neighborhood. And one time, Mel was sick and I couldn't go. And Bill Mullins came at midnight with his horn, with a real trumpet. And so I came out and I said, well, we can't go. And so he said, oh, come on. Mel was not feeling well. And the next morning, I went out to get the newspaper, and I saw a paper cup of champagne in the snow that he had left. That was just so touching at the time. And everybody had a dog. We knew Ebony Levine, Frank Nagin, Lady Allen.
You know. 3 o'clock p.m., 74 degrees Fahrenheit.
In fact, on Brushcliff Road, there's a dead dog buried in every backyard. So, I don't know exactly where, but there is. I know where Snoopy is.
That was your dog?
Yeah, that was ours. Bobby came home, and he had dug the place in it. We knew she was going, and he dug it out so that he wouldn't have such a hard time when the ground was hard. And sure enough, the ground was hard. But he happened to be back again. And I remember I was at work, and Mel calls to tell me that he and Bobby had taken Soupy to... She couldn't even stand up, you know. The sadness about that is every morning there was a... Jackson was a dog from way down the hill, would come up the hill. He and Snoopy would sniff their noses a little bit. And then Snoopy would come back in, and the dog and Jackson would go. Well, when Snoopy died, Jackson kept coming up and scratching on the door, and we tried to tell him, but he came up for about a year, and I don't know whether he couldn't make the hill or not, or what happened. But that was also a touching story. Yeah, when we got Snoopy, Mel and Sally had gone down Wilkinsburg Hill to his biology teacher, who was giving away dogs. Larry said, "Oh, look, my biology teacher's giving dogs. Isn't this wonderful?" I said, "Take that dog back." And, oh, the kids were crying. "No, no, no. Well, tomorrow, there's no school. All right, we'll take it back Monday." So I put a mat in the bathroom that was between Larry and Bobby's rooms. And "You're taking it back." We never took it back. I said, "I'm not feeding another kid. I fed another kid."
Did you work at the Monroeville store at all?
Very rarely. I didn't. I had four kids at home. Although they were growing up by then. Not all. Larry was 15 that time we went to see Rose. I remember that. But I didn't. I didn't. Tell you the truth, I never really liked working the store.
How come?
Why don't I like listen to certain bands? Just is.
Yeah. When did you start writing your column? Or how did it come about, maybe, is a better question.
Well, how did I start writing the column? I went to Al Bloom, and I asked him for a job. And he said, "There's no job here for you." I wanted a part-time job. He said, "There's no job here for you." Well, the next thing we know, I was writing a column in Monroeville, the Monroeville paper that Cliff Thompson had given me. I had no money for it, but, you know, just a column. And so Al apparently saw it, and he called me up later, and he said, "Would you like to like a scene column once a week?" I said, "Sure." And he said, and I just sworn to my name, Beverly King Paul. "No, you have to have a name." So Shirley and I, at the time, were joking about some things, and she would ask me for something, and she said, "What do you think, Quotha?" And so I would quote some stupid thing like, "Every hearth better a clean hearth than a dirty chamber," or something like that. It really didn't make any sense. And she would, "Thank you, Quotha." And so I don't know. Out of my head came the names Quotha Maven, because Maven was really tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
And the column was sort of like a Jewish Irma Bombeck. And I learned from her that she never named the name of her kid. My first column or two, I put the names of my kids. And I noticed that she never did. And there's a reason for it. This way, if you don't put the names of the kids, they can more easily identify with it. In fact, from the column, I got lots of offers to make speeches. And here I never stand in front of 10 people in my life. But you do, you know. And I can remember one time, I mean, mostly my audiences were older people. And then I went to this house, and I looked, oh, my God, there's not a woman here who's over 28. But they loved my speech anyhow because they identified with my kids. The older people identified with me. And this particular group identified with my kids. And they liked the speech, so I was very happy about that.
How did the column get syndicated?
I did it.
What did that involve?
I had a real good, I don't know, I hope I saved it. It's a piece, you know, that I did, and was real cute with portions of speeches and so forth. And then I attached a card. Yes, please send me the column. No, not right now. Maybe I'll think about it. Well, yeah, now that I thought about it, please send me that real funny stuff. And that's how it went. Now, they didn't stay with me forever. In fact, there was one guy who, as soon as he would get, for some reason or other, papers, they needed an editor, and they got him. As soon as he got in, he'd take me out, and then he'd go to another city and take me out again. And it was annoying, but there was nothing I could do about it. So it got toward the end. It was mostly Baltimore, Albany, Schenectady, and Troy. And Boston. Those papers were the ones that hung out the longest. I was very naive and unaware of how you go about doing those things. And I just did it. I could have maybe if I'd worked at it harder, except that I got a real job at the Federation, and it was just no time left.
How did the Federation job come about?
It was really, real interesting. Because of Quotha Maven, I'd asked Jerry Soroka, who was head of the Federation, for a job, part-time job, and he said, there's nothing here. So because of the column, the women's division of the Federation asked me to be on the board. And it so happened that my first job was to introduce the executive director who was going to speak. Well, usually, you know, you spend 2 minutes, you know, you spend a half an hour. I spent 2 or 3 hours writing that speech. And I knew it was good, but I didn't realize it was that good because they were falling over on the floor laughing. I really didn't mean it to be that, you know. So after this, so what happened is I learned a couple things. Number one, you're never funnier than the boss. Number two, you're not so funny that you put him in an awkward position when he's going to give a speech, you know, that's a serious speech. You don't put too much humor in it ahead of time. So anyhow, got through, and Jerry said, I'm going to Israel for a couple of weeks. Call me when I get back, or I'll call you. Well, I waited about 3 weeks. He never called, so I called him. And he said, our PR director is leaving in 6 weeks. Would you like her job? It's a full-time job. So I said, let me think about it. So I knew when I went home that I was going to take that job. But beforehand, I went to her office. I looked around. I asked her how much money she made. And it worked out well. Today, that could never happen.
How come?
Because you need more. I mean, what kind of bio did I have? I had Quoth the Maven, you know. I didn't have any newspaper experience. Well, that was newspaper experience, but it was different. It wasn't the kind of Federation stuff necessarily. So I remember I got the job. I said, I'll take the job if I can work with her for 6 weeks before she leaves. So he said, okay. And that was good because I didn't know what the hell a news release was. So I got in there, and she said, okay, write this news release for this whatever. And it so happened that for years, the scrapbooks, they'd saved scrapbooks from various events, because it's the same thing. So I looked at her release, and I wrote one better, and that was that.
How long were you at the Federation?
18 years. High life. I had a very interesting... they threw a party for me. And, of course, I had a speech, which was very well received. So that was kind of fun. And I'm sorry, in some ways, that I left, quote, the Maven.
How come?
Because it was like a chronology of my family. Now, Sally would be upset if something happened, and I sort of exaggerate a little bit to make it, you know, more of a beginning, a middle, and an end. Sally wants exactly the way it was. Sally, that's not interesting particularly, you know. So you have to, just like Mark Twain said, I remember everything, whether it happened or not. So I just love that. I think that's such a wonderful thing. I wrote a column. It may even be in that book, I'm not sure. Making fun of the fact that you don't have to be well-read. You don't have to know anything. All you have to do is memorize certain quotations, and that'll get you through. Like you're out for dinner, and everybody's trying to decide what to eat. Oscar Levant says, the minute I make up my mind, I'm filled with indecision. And then you stick around. You're a writer? Yeah. Somerset Maugham said that people become writers because they always think of the right thing to say afterwards. And what about, I forget her name. Anyhow, she was very good, and she says, I hate writing, but I love having written.
That was
Parker.
Yeah.
What's her first name?
Dorothy.
Thank you. Dorothy Parker, yeah. So that was a funny column, and then I forget how I ended it somehow. Said I have to memorize a few columns before my friends, they realize that they're saying the same ones, you know. They can't remember what you've said, so... Anyhow, it was kind of fun.
Can you talk about starting Jews with AIDS in the Family?
Yeah. In 1990, our son Bobby, who was born in 1955, his partner, Robert, said that he couldn't take care of him because he had to keep his job with his, otherwise he'd lose his insurance. So we went that was 1990, October. So Melvin said, I'll go next door and tell the neighbors that we'll be away for a while. And I said, what are you going to tell them? He said, the truth, what else? That was the most liberating thing. You have no idea how liberating the truth can be. Because if you're lying about something, you have to remember the lie. You don't know who you told, who you didn't tell, whatever. And the truth of the matter is all our friends knew anyhow. They could tell the way. We had an anniversary party, I think, for us or something, and I looked at that picture of Larry, and, oh, God, he looked awful. And the same with Bobby. You know, and your friends know they're just dear friends, and they're not going to bring it up if you don't. So, anyhow, we went to somewhere in L.A. I've forgotten where the suburb was. And it was Mike, not Bob. Robert was Larry's problem. It was Mike. And his mother was very kind to me, too. So anyhow, we went to take care of Larry, Bobby, and they were the worst 4 months of our lives. It was just terrible, just terrible. Because Bobby's personality was changing. You know, he was becoming aggressive, and was Bobby. It was, God knows what, but it did change back. And John said that his friends should get closure. So we had a I don't know if you call it a meeting or a group together of all his friends, you know, at the hospital. And John did the service, which I thought was lovely. And I just remember one doctor saying, there's good and there's bad. He says, the good is that he was the best. And the bad is that we'll never be able to replace him. And I thought that was so dear of the doctor he'd worked for.
What was the situation of gay people within the Jewish community at that time?
It was not so terrific. It depends on the person, I guess, really. For them to write that bad notice to the Chronicle and for me to answer it, you know, that shows that they were there.
What about just in sort of casual conversation? I mean, did your friends know?
All my friends knew, and they were all like us, you know, we were good liberal Jews. And they were all very solicitous. But, you know, we went there in those days. You didn't know if you touched a gay person if you'd get AIDS. See, nobody knew then. I remember Melvin dropped his bite plate in the bathroom floor, and we were terrified. We didn't know what to do with it. And finally, we just said, the hell with it. And we were careful, you know, in terms of blood or fecal matters. But, you know, no problem. And afterwards, I think I may have told you, whenever Mel and I were like on several panels, and there was an AIDS 101 speaker, a good friend of ours, and then Mel and I would tell our stories, and then I would introduce the young man or woman with AIDS, and I'd make a point of hugging and kissing them, so that hopefully that message, without being said, would indicate that you can hug and kiss a person who has AIDS. So there are certain things I remember, certain things I don't. I guess when we're getting ready to leave, I think what helped me somewhat was that when we were taking care of Bobby, I looked at it as if we were looking a play. It wasn't me, it was something else. And I wrote notes accordingly. And I had a whole bunch of little notes that I had, I remember, with a red pen. And I looked at them, and I said, should I take this with me or not? And after debating with myself, I threw it away, because it was such pain. And I just didn't want to go through that again. But
what led to starting the organization?
Jews with AIDS. Well, I figured that there were other people just like us. And I made up several flyers that the newspaper accommodated us, and we didn't have to pay for them. And I wasn't working for the Federation. Yes, I was. I was working for the... No, I wasn't. I was retired. And so I said, everybody knows Jews don't get AIDS. I think that's a flyer, one of the flyers I had. Well, anyhow, so we had our first meeting at the Tree of Life Synagogue, and we had like about 12, 15 people, which was, I expected nobody to show up. So that was good. And we met for a while, See, the interesting thing about our group is we did what everybody said won't work. I said, you can't have the parents and the children in the same group. I said, yes, we can, and we did.
What was the argument against doing that?
Well, because kids may not want to talk in front of parents. Parents may not want to talk in front of kids.
And why were you insistent on doing it that way?
Because that just made more sense to me. That just made more sense to us. Or maybe it's because the two of us wanted to be in on it. I don't know. But we did, and we... I have... That notebook you have is pretty well documented of what happened at each meeting.
Yeah.
And the reason we had to leave the Tree of Life is at one time the Weisses were there, and somebody said... They had some other kind of meeting at the Tree of Life. They said, oh, what are you doing here? And the Weiss, she was flustered. She didn't know what to say. And so we realized we couldn't meet there anymore. And so then the Jewish Family and Children's Service allowed us to meet there at their building on Sundays. And Rachel Rosen was our first person. And after that was... I was just thinking it. Well, it's written down.
Yeah.
She was a darling girl. And
what was the idea behind having a support group?
Well, there's just something that if you know somebody else feels the same way, it's just sort of an acceptance, an embracing of it. And it was a way that you can talk in that group that nobody else has to hear you say it. You can say your feelings. In fact, a very funny thing is we had a Catholic guy in our group because he didn't want to go to his group because they would know who he was. So he was more comfortable with us. I mean, I don't know if it makes any sense, but it's just the way it was. And we lost about nine Jews, nine boys. And it was tough. It was tough. But...
Did the broader Jewish community support the group?
Well, I went to the Federation, to the foundation. I knew Lenny Rudolph real well, and asked him for $1,500 because we wanted to buy some pens that said "Jews with AIDS" and the Jews with AIDS, and we bought them. And I probably have one around if you want it.
We might have one. I'll have to check.
Okay. Okay. But...
Was there any pushback?
There was. We didn't know about it. There was. We didn't know about it. But that was so sweet of Lenny Rudolph. You know, he knew... I explained the whole thing, you know, to the board and to the foundation board and everything. He said, come on. Give the $1,500, you know. Next, you know, he wanted us to have it.
Yeah.
We did. Helped us buy the pens. And then several of us gave $100 for more pens or something. I don't recall, really. But they disappeared fairly quickly. We tried to get $100 for each, but it didn't work out that way. Not everybody was willing to pay $100.
Were you involved with Bet Tikva during that time?
Yes. And, you know, I think what happened is we were probably one of the first, if not the first, parents that went to services there. And there was a reason for that, because we wanted them to feel parental acceptance. And we just sort of got accepted. It was good not only for them, it was very good for us too, because we were still fragile.
Did you have any children living in Pittsburgh at the time?
No.
So you just went as a couple?
We just went as a couple, right. See, this is, when did I say it was? 19, I can't remember.
It was the early 90s when you started the group.
Yeah, it was the early 90s. Yeah, that's right, because Bobby died in 91, so it had to be after that, 92, 93, something like that. So we went there, and they felt good, I think, about having us. I mean, they were loving of us as we were loving of them.
Where were they meeting at the time?
They were meeting at the small room at the temple, the big temple in town.
Rhoda,
thank you.
So they were meeting in the Cohen Chapel.
Yeah, that's where we met. And then after a while, the services, you know, depend on who was in charge of the service at the time. They started, you know, digging into the service itself, you know, to make it more interesting religiously. And a lot of people really put themselves, Deb Polk is one of them, and Barbara
Goldman,
thank you, is another one. And there's another one too. Oh, Nachum Golan was there, active too. I met him there. And forgotten this woman's name. She's a good speaker. You'll probably have her name down.
Was it Shirley? Shirley Supernow?
I'm not sure. Does some quite sound familiar. I think she had blonde hair. And she seems tall to me in my memory. I don't know. Anyhow, it was a secure place and everybody felt acceptance there. You know, it's funny, when that note that I wrote, when the Chronicle said something bad about gays and I responded, they moved the service to the regular room of the temple, and they gave out a piece of paper that had the bad guys column and my column on the side of it, and everybody had it, and I just felt so good about that it was important to them, to what I had said. And it was interesting about that, though. My nephew David came because he wanted to see what was going on. And there was a lawyer there that was a friend of his that he knew. And I felt so bad. And Davey just talked to him like, you know, he was just a regular guy. But I think the guy was there to be part of the service. And, of course, he could never come back.
Because his confidentiality had
exactly,
been broken.
Exactly. So I felt, I can't recall his name, but I remember feeling, oh, David, you know.
How long did you remain affiliated with Bet Tikva?
I still belong.
When did you and Mel stop going regularly?
I don't know. We just enjoyed going. Maybe Temple David may have kind of gotten in the way. I don't remember.
Bet Tikva only met like once a month, though, right?
Yeah.
So you could do both.
Yeah. Deb Polk, P-O-L-K, was very active. She kept going to this newsletter. And for a long time, she and her partner had a little baby girl. And that was exciting. So, but I remember going to Rhoda for certain kinds of services. I may be mistaken. But, you know, it's real interesting that you ask about the support group. People just like to be belong to a place that's confidential and that's warm and fuzzy, you know, that they feel at home. Because when they face the outside world, it ain't always that way. And they always like a place they can return to. And that's why we had the Jews with AIDS, because people would talk there with other Jews, but they didn't want to be other people to know about it.
Why was it important for the organization to be Jewish?
Because we were Jewish. And Jews feel that sometimes they're they're left out of certain things. And this way we had our own organization. And we could say whatever we wanted to say. And there were parents, and there were sons. I don't think there were any daughters. But it was, it was hard when a guy died, you know. You hope. I'll tell you one story that I don't think I want you to repeat it.
This will be on tape, so should we not have it on tape?
We don't know the guys. We don't know who did it. We don't know the people. It's just such a touching story. This one guy was from Israel. And one of our people supported him. You know, helped them with food, helped them do all kinds of things. And then the guy was ultra Orthodox. And the reason he came here is he didn't want his parents to know that he was gay. And I don't know whether he got AIDS here or whether he got it there, because I'm not certain. But all I know is this one guy who was not gay. We had people who were straight and gay in our group. And it was like the helpers and the people who were helped. And he took real good care of this guy. And he saw that he was dying. And he called his family in Israel. And they rushed here. And they forgave each other. And they hugged and kissed. And he died 28 minutes later. That was really something. And the irony is, because he called the family and broke confidentiality, he lost his membership in the task force. Because you can't do that.
The task force was Jews with AIDS in the Family? Or the AIDS task force?
Pittsburgh AIDS Task Force. Which now is something else. It's another name now, and I can't recall it. And I'm not sure if the mission is different. I'm just not certain, because I'm not familiar with the task force anymore.
But the point is that there was a bit of an irony in that he made this decision that was very helpful on an individual level, but it was a violation of
his
responsibility.
Exactly. And you imagine those poor parents. God. So luckily it worked out.
Why did Jews with AIDS and the Family stop?
There really wasn't a need for the service. Once you come well accepted into the general community, for some reason or other, you don't need a smaller one.
About what year did that happen?
You have it in your book.
Okay, so it's whenever the records stop.
Yeah, yeah.
So it wasn't around very long.
Not long, but it really served a real purpose.
Yeah.
And I said before, we lost nine boys, and that means that some parents were involved, some were not. And it was this one. There was another guy who was a genius. And during the 70s, when there was a gas rationing thing, he hated waiting in line, so he invented his car. He had it. He changed it so that it could run without gas. I mean, I don't know how he did it, but he could. Maybe it was oil or something, I don't know. But we found out, his mother was the one who was, he was with us for quite a while, and he didn't want his mother to come. And he says, I'll let you know when I want her. And he was very quiet, very sweet boy. But I learned afterwards, in fact, there's a piece in the book about it, that he was a genius, and he finally did ask his mother to come, and she was with us for quite a while after he died too.
Aside from Bet Tikva and Jews with AIDS in the Family, were there other organizations in Pittsburgh that you were involved in?
Well, I'm a member of Hadassah.
But I mean that concerned your...
Concerned AIDS.
Yeah.
I can't really... Jewish organizations.
No, they don't have to be Jewish.
Oh, Shepherd Wellness Community, really, they were wonderful.
What did they do?
Well, they had, again, parents and kids. And the irony is that all those parents are gone now, except me. Because I'm old, you know. They weren't all that many service people. But they were wonderful. You know, Mel and I came back from L.A. after Bobby died, and we wanted to find out about AIDS. So we looked up AIDS in the phone book. And there was the task force in Persad in this little place called Shepherd Wellness Community. And it was just so wonderful. Everybody was so loving and so warm and so understanding. And Father Lynn Edwards, he's the one who really started the organization. He started it in 1985, I think. And at first it was just whenever they'd have a dinner, it would just bring whatever you want to bring. Sometimes it could be all desserts or it could be all this. So for their holiday dinner, they called it Christmas dinner then, they decided to have it catered. This is 1985, maybe 1986. So they had it catered. And when the guy found out that it was for those people with AIDS, he dropped it in the snow and ran out. This was their first catered dinner. So it gives you an idea of how things were at that time. But Mel and I didn't become active until 1991. That's when we came back from Bobby. We wanted to do whatever we could do for kids with AIDS. And that's when we became involved. We found Shepherd Wellness was like more of a family-oriented thing. And that's why we did it. And Father Lynn was such a dear guy. He said, he called me his Jewish mother, and I called him my Episcopal father. So he just died recently. He really started the help for AIDS. He did a lot of things, you know. In the beginning, some funeral homes didn't want to take people with AIDS. So he had to make sure everybody had a place to be buried.
Was there a lot of interfaith work around this subject?
Well, we just didn't care. You know, it was not... It was all interfaith, I guess.
I guess what I mean is, did the issue allow people to put aside other differences because they had this in common?
Maybe. I guess so. We just felt so intense then. It was a lot of intense feeling. And you just felt intense about everything, you know. And now I think about it, I still have the feeling, but the feeling of intensity is not quite there anymore.
It's not as raw as it used to be.
No, because it's open. It's open now, you know. And people talk about it. You know, they never used to talk about AIDS. I do it with my various groups here to see how it's going. Maybe that all my friends are liberal, I don't know. But there's certainly no concern, no problem.
What made you decide to write the play about your son and about the whole subject?
Well, I studied playwriting for 12 years. But interesting enough, both those plays happened after those 12 years. But Kathy George critiqued my plays before they were done, you know, before I turned them in completely. And she also did the ones that I did loosely based on our experience with Bobby. Not not completely. And so she came, Kathy came to the auditorium, you know, where it was being, the second one was being previewed. And I sat next to her, which I probably shouldn't have. But afterwards, she got up, and I didn't know that our director was a wreck when she saw her either. So Kathy said, "Oh, how did you do it? You did such a great job." So to her, you know, and therefore to me, or to me both. And that was a good feeling. However, the play here was more of a reading than a play. And the play actually was about an hour and 20-30 minutes. But Susan Klassen said, "It's going to be a reading. It's going to be an hour." And she gave the director, Freddie, I forget Freddie's last name. So Freddie took it upon himself to take out a half hour. So I read it, read his thing, and it was two things I really was a little uncomfortable with. So I called him up and I said, "Freddie, would you like to come for dinner?" He said, "Sure, can I bring my husband?" "Of course." So they came over for dinner, and while Freddie's reading the play, some of my suggestions, I'm showing Eric around. I went into my bedroom in there and I showed him the pictures of Larry and Bobby. I could see them then. And it was, I don't know if it strikes you the way it strikes me, but I was showing him all these pictures of me here, you know, this is me, and here is my wedding picture. And he looked at it for a long time. And you know what he said? "That Mel was gorgeous," which I thought was so funny, because I'm showing him all of me, you know. But he showed was more important to him, which I thought was wonderful. I love that. "And Mel was gorgeous." So anyhow, the one I wanted to put back in, and we did, and we both were not happy with the conclusion. We worked on that for a long time. And I finally forgot how it ended. But the interesting thing is, my daughter Susan was here, and she had seen the other one. But this was a reading, and Susan said she felt that this play was more intense because it was just right there, you know. And the boy, the guy that played the boy by the son, oh, was he good. He was even better than the guy in Pittsburgh. Anyhow, it was, she felt that this play was intense. Anyhow, it was pretty funny because after the play was over, Freddie helped me up. I didn't have my walker with me. He had it put away. He helped me up and I sat down and I took questions. And I was real, they were interesting. And Susan said she was real pleased because she says, you know, sometimes older people, like they forget and they stutter and they talk. I thought that was funny. But anyhow, what brought down the house was the last end, everybody was saying real nice things about me. So I said, after hearing all those nice things said about me, I can hardly wait to hear myself talk. And they laughed, and that was the end of that. But then there were refreshments and so forth. But it was a nice day for a 93-year-old lady, or 92, whatever I was.
Is there anything else you'd like to have on the record?
About what?
Your life.
My life? I don't know. I'm content with my life now. I'd call it happy if Mel were here. But he isn't, so I'm just content.
All right, maybe we'll leave it there.
Okay.
So we have this release form, and since it's got writing on it,
you can sign it.
Well, I figured I'd read it to you. Just
you can sign it if you want to.
Just so that you know what you're signing.
Okay.
So it goes like this. It says I blank. So that'll be your name. Hereby authorize the Senator John Hines History Center to possess and use my audio or video recorded oral history memoirs. It is my understanding that the original tape, or an acceptable copy, tape log, tape abstract, or full transcription will be donated and become the property of the Heinz History Center. I also understand that information from my interview may be used for research, quotation, publication, and other purposes in the larger study of Western Pennsylvania history, per the restrictions listed below. Is that acceptable?
Sure.
Do you want any restrictions?
Nah.
Okay, that means people will be able to listen to it as soon as we get it all sorted out.
Yeah, I don't care.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, dear.